Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. I'm really excited to have Jorlik Schmidt join us today from Willingness to Pay, because pricing is so important and it can change everything in your driving growth. And it's so hard to do. And now with AI out there and trying to figure that out, I'm just really excited to have you here, Jorlik. And maybe you can introduce yourself, do a better job than me, and we can get into a great conversation.
Sure. I'll be happy to. Let's do the short version. So I started as an entrepreneur, had a business, sold that, had another business, sold that, was about to start my third business when somebody asked me to co-write a book about pricing psychology. So I did that. And then people started to ask me about pricing. And then I didn't say no. And I think 2 years into that, my wife said, "You're a consultant." And they're like, "Sure." And then, okay. So that's what I've been for about 10 years. I was very lucky back in 2017, 18, right after I got started, to be the preferred pricing partner of Microsoft Western Europe. So I did a lot of heavy on-prem to cloud lifts into Asia. And then since that, I've done maybe 150 projects. I think about last year, I started a team, partly because I just had way more demand for work that I could ever deliver. So yeah, so now we're a small team, about 10 people, spread out a little bit in North America, a little bit in Europe. I'm based in Europe, but we work globally.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's like you could, if there's one thing you could change in your go-to-market, better product, better marketing, better sales. But there's one thing that changes everything is price. And if you get it right, you can keep doing what you're doing and drive higher growth and profit. And but is it like, I read your website a little bit, like you need, it's a science and an art. And anyways, I'm just like admiring, because we've gotten through this fate. We've priced so many products over the years and it's so important.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think when I had my businesses to start with, I was as clueless. Like I was doing the same as everyone else. I was like, okay, if we double the price, we can afford to lose half the customers, like that kind of math. And then I think I started to approach it as a very integrated part of the customer journey and the product itself. And then I think I flipped a switch somehow. I said, hey, I think actually we're trying to solve the wrong problem. So we're trying to price the product and actually not price the customer. And I think especially with software where you have, so part of one of the features of software is that supply is in a sense unlimited, like you can deliver it to, you're never going to run out. So really what you're trying to do is you're trying to craft the right value proposition to the right types of customers with the right types of use cases, and then putting a price on that rather on your bits and pieces and buttons and levers and whatever it is, right? And I think that turned it for me into a design task more than a spreadsheet task. And I think that approach has been really fruitful with, let's say, sorting through a lot of very complex issues for the projects that I've done.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, design led. So you must do a lot of understanding the customer and value point, and then look at the, is there a process to how you do this or?
Yeah, so now, in the beginning, no. Now more, right? So I think so what we usually do is I present when I do keynotes, I present the process as solving for risk, right? So when we haven't done the tally for last year, but the projects that we concluded in 2022 and 2023, the average price increase we did for those were 242%. So we do, let's say, massive commercial transformations more than we do 5-10% increases. So you can see that sort of a full-on redesign or realignment of the relationship you have with your customers, what they're even buying and why. And then we reprice that. So in order for me, I found out, to get a CEO to walk into a room and demand for his most strategic account that pricing was now going to be 5 times as high, whatever. There was no spreadsheet or PowerPoint that could convince him to have that conversation without like folding his hand at some point. So what we did was we said, okay, so what needs to happen before that in order for him or her to have that conversation successfully, right? And then we said, okay, so maybe we, before we do the most strategic accounts, we need to have done it for the, let's say, middle segment of the accounts. Okay, so if we've done it there, surely we can do the large ones. And then we just move the problem. So before we can do the middle ones, we'll do all the small ones. And before we do the small ones, we'll have tested it in the market. Before we test it in the market, we validated it with interviews and these things. Before we do that, we validated internally across the organization to build confidence. And before we do that, we secure some management buy-in. And then you just flip the entire process, and then that's how you start. So usually what I start with is a very small team, 5 people max, even if we're doing projects for companies with close to $1 billion in revenue. We're doing 5 people max in what I call a core team, someone with product understanding, someone with commercial understanding. And then we basically talk about what it is that your customers are trying to buy from you. What is the outcome that you're selling? What is the job to be done? And then we structure the market segmentation and the product packaging around that. And then we find, let's say, appropriate pricing models to then get at those outcomes. And then we work from there until we have a version one, which we then validate, sales test, and then start this sort of renewal and migration process throughout the customer base. So that's basically the process.
Yeah. And how much does competition pricing play into your thought process?
It can quite a bit. So what we do, actually, we have a whole fake consulting front out there. So we mystery shop our clients' competitors. And actually, in some of the cases where we do the most extreme price increases is when we find out that our clients are just underpriced, maybe not on a whole, but maybe for segments of customers. So let's say you have small, medium, large accounts. And let's say for the smaller accounts, you're pretty much like on par with your competitors on price. But maybe on the large accounts, you're way cheaper, right? You're discounting, it just holds you down. And if they ever were to churn and go to whatever your closest competitors, they would have to pay 3 times as much. That is just easy money if we know that, to then go and execute on something like that. So what we do is we extract all the pricing from the competitors on a, let's say, model basis. And then we calculate the competitors' pricing for each of our clients' customers. So if you have 100 customers, we'll know for each of them what they would pay more or less with competitor A, B, and C.
I'm curious what your thoughts are. There's like a private equity playbook, which is, okay, let's look at gross dollar retention. So GDR, and we have to have a certain renewal rate. We want to like sign always 3-year deals. And we want our contracts to have like incremental annual price increase. And so you're always like, you're coming out into the next year with, they say best practice, like 130% of GDR, which I personally think that's really hard, but that's what they say. And what are your thoughts on like this 3-year contracts and incremental price increase every year on products? What's your point of view there?
So when we do pricing, we do mostly redesigns. And then you don't do a redesign every year, obviously. But once you've done a redesign, you have a structure that you can then start to optimize on. And that's basically what you might call pricing upkeep or pricing maintenance. And there you do something like inflation plus value increase of your product, less whatever competitors are doing, like something around. That's not an exact science, but that's like the guiding principle of how you should adjust pricing on an annual basis, right? So you say, hey, like inflation was 4%. We had a lot of really valuable new product. The competitors didn't. Let's go 15% this year, something like that. That's basically the approach. And then you just do that every year. And then that will, like, your customers will get used to it for sure. A lot of their other vendors are already doing it, so why not you? And then I would say that I don't 3-year contracts. There are exceptions, but as a general rule, if you're doing B2B SaaS, go for annual contracts at the most. because that will allow you to do those, let's say, adjustments on an annual basis, and also allow you to, for example, take new product roadmap, new features, put into existing products, and then reprice those, thus saving you technical complexity, saving you the necessity of having salespeople go and sell the new add-on or feature, whatever it is, and then having a not 100% attach rate on that and so forth, right? So it's just a way better and more, let's say, leaner way of monetizing the roadmap as it rolls forward to just having shorter term contracts, like annual contracts, and just adjusting prices as you go along. That's and especially with AI, who does 3-year contracts right now with AI?
Yeah, hold on with the AI. I want to ask you about AI. But that's interesting because everything I've been hearing, reading, and even our own philosophy, it's okay, we should always lead with 3-year deals and we get paid up front. And then we have incremental price increase in there. And then you try and renew it every year. So like you're pushing it out the third year, Like we heard that as a best practice. You can't do it with all your accounts and it happens slowly, but then you're assured cash flow upfront, you're assured revenue, but you don't just leave them for 3 years. You try and extend their 3-year annually. Like, what are your thoughts around that?
So the whole idea is, are you trying to solve a churn problem? Yes or no? I'm talking to a 50 million US software operator. They have 2% churn and they do a mix of contracts. So it's like, in my opinion, that churn is too low. Like it should be higher. Like it economically doesn't make sense to have that. So it's like, why are you trying to lock people into longer contracts? The software already locks the customer in. You don't need the added layer of the contract. So it's almost like the 3-year, the multi-year contract is a band-aid if your product can't retain the customer on its own. And usually what will happen if you do a 3-year contract is that customers intuitively will try to exchange that for a lower price. So let's say your annual price is 100.
Definitely.
And they'll do, okay, so we'll do 3 years and then we'll do a 10% discount. So now your 3-year lifetime value is 270. Okay. And then you have built in like price adjustments. So you'll do 90, 95, 100, something like that. So you'll do, okay, so it's 285. But if you had an annual renew contract where you just say, hey, I'll let you know what the price is, you might go 100, 110, 120, because that's what the product is worth. So now you have an annual like 3-year value of 330 versus 285. So you're missing, 45, so 15% more or less.
Yeah.
Of the total value of that account. And then that gap just widens and widens as you go through year 3, 4, like 4, 5, and 6 as you go out. And then also it creates these dynamics inside of the product organization where whenever you come bring a net new feature that's really awesome, like you have a good innovation, it's almost you can't just insert it into the existing product, because then you can't make money from it, because that is already locked in commercially in the existing contracts you have. So you spin it out as an additional add-on. So you get this, I just wrote this newsletter this morning that I called SKU spaghetti, like stock keeping units. Like you have too many products because the complexity just grows and grows over time. And if you have too many SKUs, at some point your salespeople don't have the bandwidth to just talk through each and every one of them with your account. So you end up underselling or under-solutioning your accounts with all these products. And it actually starts by having not the right contract framework in place or the right commercial relationship in place with your customers.
Yeah, I thought you would have said you like 3-year deals. So the benefit, like that, what you point out is true. You're giving up 15%, but the benefit is you're freeing your sales team up to go either expansion revenue or new logos. And
I would argue that 3-year renewal is like a war. And that's, I have a US client, we're wrapping up a project. They grew from 4 million to 85 in 3 or 4 years. Massive growth.
Amazing.
Great. They hit like a COVID wave a little bit and so forth. And then they stalled out hard because they were selling only like Fortune 500, like blue chip accounts. And suddenly the 3-year contracts caught up with them and they had renewals. And that just sucked all the oxygen out of the sales team, because now they had to basically run 2 massive renewals every week. And then they had no time left over because these procurement teams had just been preparing for 2 years for gutting them. So I would say it's a much better approach to just have a lighter annual adjustment with a predetermined agreement that we're going to let you know what the price is. And that's how we do business. And then upsells can and extensions can happen as a natural course of that. But the pricing itself is not really up for that big renegotiation over 3 years where you have to re-agree on a price. And I'm aware that I'm contrarian to this. Yeah. I won't say that there are no circumstances under which multi-year contracts aren't the best deal. There certainly are. But by and large, people overuse them. And it builds up a lot of operational debt inside of organizations because of this variance in contracting and this sort of incentive to not have a lean and clean packaging structure that you take to market.
Yeah. And then what do you say to having all that cash flow up front? So we get paid ahead on a 3-year deal. So we get
all 3 years?
Yeah, we get paid up front for 3 years. So it gives us all that cash flow, and which is great. Does that tip your thinking a little bit or no?
A little bit. I'd say if you have to do multi-year contracts, get all 3 years up front, right? So then it's your cash. So then at least you get to spend it now. I would say if you have a solid business and you have good EBIT margins and so forth, why not get 15% more over the next 3 years? Like if you've been in business 36 years, like you know that you're going to be in business for the next 3 years and the next six and the next nine. So why not just take that extra like 20% on top, which is going to be pure profit, right? By just collecting your time.
Yeah, that's what our finance team thinks. They're like, why are we giving up 15%? And they're like, you're right. It's really the software that makes them stay with you. It's not the contract.
So I'll let you know what I do with 3-year contracts. If customers ask for it, I say, okay, so the price is 100 and they say, oh, we want a 3-year contract and then we want a discount. I say, no, so you don't get it. If I give you a 3-year contract, the price is going to be 110. So it's going to be an increase in price, but because you're taking away my ability to commercially operate. And from a software perspective, like from a product perspective, like you want us to keep developing the product, right? Yes, everybody agrees with that. Okay, so if we do that, which is in our best interest as well, we actually don't know what product we're going to sell you in 3 years because it's going to be different, right? We're going to materially change it over the next 3 years. So how can we today agree on a price of something in a new market condition 3 years from now on a product we don't know what is?
Yeah.
So how about we instead just say, we'll figure it out as we go along. So our promise to you as a vendor talking to a client would be, we will constantly test the pricing in the market with new accounts. And if we can sell at a certain price, that's also the price that we will get our existing customers, like with some delay. So you can always rest assured that we will never treat you unfairly, but we will treat you in accordance with what the market is willing to bear. That's the term, right?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, and I think I've had government entities, Fortune 500 clients across multiple continents, let's say, lean into this logic after a while. It's not necessarily easy. I want to stress that, but it can get done. And the benefits are quite tremendous, actually.
Yeah, it is. You do have a different point of view from what people like are really into 3-year deals, money up front. But I'm going to have to think about that more. From experience, we've had a lot of enterprise customers that had gotten such good deals, and then we can't raise them so much any year that they're still always 30%, sometimes 40% below our current list price after many years of innovation. And it's like, because we're governed by some terms and conditions and them being so big of a customer of ours for so long that we can't just say it's a 50% price increase or 30% price increase. And
you can, but it's going to be a different kind of year. So that's what we do, right? So we help businesses through exactly these kinds of, so I call this concept commercial debt, right? It's like technical debt. It's just on the commercial side of things. It's okay, all our contracts have different prices, different, let's say, addendums, maybe different wording, different terms, different payment profiles, different whatever. So just cleaning that up and just bringing it up to space and creating like Reagan came in and created, I think it was Reagan, created like the New Deal. Let's say, hey, we're gonna wipe this, like clean slate, New Deal. This is how we're going to do business. And then you construct a narrative around why that's necessary, why it's now, and so why it's going to be good for both of us going forward, and so on. Because I think fundamentally, consider this. If you charge 100 to your customers, whatever that is, then that is also the budget you have to then do everything. Like sell them, have profits, overhead, build new product, all of that. The money they give you is the money you have. So if you get into this deficit relationship with your clients, it's almost like you're starving each other, right? Like they're not paying you enough and you can't pay them back in new product value over time.
It's true.
So you need to say, hey, I refuse to continue this way because it's not supporting the overall vision we have for the product. So we want to like clean slate, new deal, reset the pricing to market standards. And then as part of that promise, we're probably going to give you some more product as in the new packaging, but as part of that promise, we're also going to reinvest a lot more into the product over time because you pay us more. And fundamentally, I think most customers get that. And so we very routinely do these complex legacy, let's say, migration cases, which usually takes 1-2 years at a time. And there's churn, but usually it's like the good kind of the customers you didn't want to keep anyways. And most customers want to understand why, but they're fundamentally, if you have a good relationship and they like the product overall, they also get why, and then they also stay on. So it can get done. And I think like at every step, the logic actually checks out. It is a better new deal for everyone.
Yeah, we've normalized. It took us 2 to 3 years to do it for everyone. We've normalized it. We did have pricing debt. Now, have you read Clayton Christensen's books? Have you read any of his books?
Yeah. No. So I did. So my first master's was in analytical philosophy in Denmark, and then my second master's was in finance at Harvard. And for whatever it kicked myself, I never actually got to meet him, but I've read a lot of his different works, and his like Competing Against Luck, his Jobs to Be Done piece is something I use and have used daily for years. I think for me, that concept is as famous as it is, it's still wildly underestimated as a North Star for how to guide product thinking.
Because I wanted to ask you a question about that, because the philosophy of, the leader keeps raising his price and then the incumbent comes in and with a lower price and starts getting market share. And then do you agree with that? Are there strategies against that, whether you're either the incumbent or the market share owner or like, what, I don't know, what, just like, I liked his books and I reflect on them, but I'm like, okay, but I don't know. What are your thoughts around that? Like
So I think sometimes this is the concept of disruption that he's built. I think his original concept was built around steel mills and like mini steel mills and US steel and all this. So I think you have it with software companies. I have a very large European client, like $10 billion plus. They do a form of hardware, and then there's a lot of software layers as well. And the Chinese is eating their lunch. Like Chinese is eating a lot of people's lunch, right? So we're having this conversation. They're saying, how do we like not have the Chinese eat our lunch? And fundamentally, you can also just see that the Chinese competitor that they're up against has a way faster cycle. Like they spin out new product innovation every 2-3 months. My client, unfortunately, takes 2-3 years and so forth, right? So it's like at some point, you just need to figure out either you're going to disrupt yourself or you're going to get disrupted. And then that's life. Like no business is forever unless you want to make some of the hard choices and disrupt yourself. And I think the hard thing is that a lot of recurring revenue businesses, they almost become like bonds. You secure this market, you log in this customer relationship with this product, and then you just collect every year. You collect, click. And then when a new entrant comes into the market, they start to chip away at your interest rate. And the only way that you can really do it is that you can set the bond on fire. You say, we're gonna give it everything away for free that we usually charge for, and then we're gonna take our resources and build the next thing. And if you can't do that as an organization, I think the best thing is to just consider your business a bond and just maximize the cash flow over the lifetime, which can be excellent. So I don't think that it is always the right strategy to try and disrupt yourself, kill your own business as the Phoenix, reinvent a new product and market. Sometimes you had a good ride and you still have plenty of cash flow left over in the sort of sunset years of this market. And you can just do that. But it is a very different business to manage. So I think it's fundamentally to figure out if you want that. I think, so for example, I work with Constellation Software. I have some framework agreements with some of their operating portfolios. And I think they had pretty much the same thing. Like they were back in the 70s, like the original Constellation Software. I forget what the product was. They captured their market. They had a great business. They didn't know how to grow. So they just took the cash flow and just reinvested in other businesses. And that was their innovation, which has worked out tremendously well. But it's but the original business with its cash flow is long gone. But they but instead of trying to salvage the original, they made just a fundamental sort of shift in what they were about and say, we are now essentially a private equity buy and hold business. And that's how we're going to operate from now on. Yeah. But it takes that decision to let it go, whatever it is that you have.
Yeah, that's some good insight there. Now, how about AI? Like, how is AI changing pricing and how to deliver software in terms of pricing?
So I think you can have a long laundry list of in ways in which it does it. So first of all, of course, it attracts a lot of funding right now. So if you slap AI on something, you get money to build it. But that's been true for a lot of new types, right? So I think the fundamental two things that you need to take into account is speed and cost. So I think one of the things that really makes pricing interesting for AI. So as a pricing consultant, we can't complain. We've had a lot of business and we're doing very well. But for some reason, and I think it's cost, AI companies are just more interested in pricing than any other of the hype waves that have gone before. So
really?
Whenever you add, and I think it's because they say, hey, we, first of all, it doesn't really make sense to the same degree to price per user. So users are a little bit out of the picture. And also we're trying to deliver like outcomes or work done. So there's this idea of agentic AI that like just does something for you. And then that almost naturally leans into a value-based pricing approach. What is it worth for you to have this thing done for you? But then, so I think there's that. And then the cost element is critical because you can't just give your customers free usage. You can't just say, hey, here's a license. You're going to pay me $1 million and then you get access to the solution. You can use it as much as you like, right? Because there is a risk that people are going to use it a lot. And not only in the unfairness of maybe they get whatever, a trillion of value out of it, but more so that they incur you far more costs on the compute and the tokens than they ever paid you. And because the software often or the solutions are such in their infancy, you don't want to have this usage-based pricing in place either. So licenses are out, we can't have a fixed price. And usage-based pricings are also out because if you give, let's say, I have a client that sells, it's in the employment, like learning management system space. And they have like online AI coaching for employees. And they have a lot of blue chip clients, like name brands in America with a lot of, like Deloitte, I think is one of their customers, maybe not Deloitte, but similar types, right? So if you are Deloitte and you're buying this and you're giving a product like that, like all of your employees have access to it and you have a usage-based pricing, then suddenly the customer is worried that you're going to have a 500 million token price attached to the software, right? Because if everybody likes it and it's awesome and everybody now spends an hour a day talking to the AI, suddenly we are on the hook for a large bill. So I think the cost element itself, because it doesn't go away, is being thrown back and forth between the AI vendor and the customer. Everybody knows that it has to be paid, like it's an infrastructure cost, but we're trying to figure out ways to have it paid while still allowing people to use the solution, play around with it, have product adoption, have expansion, all these things. And then from the AI vendor's case, also have some upfront cash flow, right? Which is why I think you're seeing a lot of these credit-based systems in AI right now, right? You buy credits, they spend the credits, then they get more credits and so forth. So credits essentially function as a form of usage-based pricing paid upfront, depending a little bit on how you structure the terms and conditions. But I think because of this cost element, this was the direction that a lot of AI went into. And I think credit systems I operate with four modalities in pricing. Yeah, pricing modalities are like flat fees, licenses, usage-based, and credit systems. And credit systems is the most complex one and the hardest one to sell and explain. It can also be tremendously powerful, but it's the one that's, let's say, has the least mileage. Like people don't know what's the best practice, how do we get it done? Billing systems aren't really set up to handle it, all these things. So I think the cost element has pushed AI in that direction, which of course means that now people have to investigate this, let's say, together as a market, right? So I think that's one thing. And then the other thing is the speed, in that you can build new AI products and then rebuild them and make them a lot better at a faster rate than you would otherwise. Which, so this multi-year contract issue that we talked about, that actually increases the, let's say, magnitude of whatever consequence you have on term length of contract, right? So if you had, oh, we're going to charge you $1 million and it's good for the 3 years and you pay us up front. And then 3 years from now, your AI product is going to be massively different. You have no overview of the cost that's going to be incurred by you or the client under, and so forth. So just, it almost intuitively feels like untenable to do pricing like that for AI products, right? Which is why they innovate.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, and there's, it's interesting, value-based pricing. There's speculation there's going to be waves. So like, I can take OpEx or expenses out of your business, value-based pricing, and then, and we'll compete like that. So I'm clearly adding value to your organization. But then as agentic AIs start competing against agentic AIs, then the pricing will start to come down. Then it's not, then you're getting back to the pricing market we're in here with typical SaaS software. Okay. But like, we'll have to maybe go through this cycle of, yeah, I can reduce customer service by 80% costs and let me benefit 30% from that or 40% from that. And you take the other 60% of value savings. And, but do you see that happening? Okay. In the beginning, we can really improve your organizational's P&L with value-based outcomes. And, but then over time we start competing against, now we're just competing against other AIs. And so now the pricing changes.
So I think that value-based pricing is like, a lot of people talk about, oh, we should do value-based pricing. It's another one of the ways in which I'm a little bit controversial at times, in that I don't believe it can always get done. A lot of pricing consultants will tell you that that's what they do and so forth. So I think value-based pricing is an option that requires two conditions to be met. One is that you don't have any competition that is meaningful, like no commoditization of your space.
Yeah.
And two, you have a very sophisticated customer that actually knows the value.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Those are difficult conditions.
But if you have that, then you can say, hey, the value of this software is $1 billion. And so what the reference point now becomes in a value-based conversation is fairness, because we both know what the value is. We both know that you can't get it anywhere else. We both know that if you don't buy from me, I also get nothing. So now it's zero. If we do business, it's $1 billion. Okay, let's share. So now it's, okay, you'll get $500 million. I'll get the other half, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So value-based pricing has a reference point in how much money you make and how much money I make. And then that's the fair exchange, right? If you have, let's say, if you have a very smart customer and you have an extremely commoditized market, then the reference point becomes cost plus, like bells of oil, extremely commoditized, extremely smart, sophisticated customers. They're just going to say, hey, I know that you pay, you know, 10 cents, so I'll give you 11. And then they give you the margin, right? So that is a cost plus based world, and you can't value price. The only way that you can value price that is by moving either to less sophisticated customers or away from a commoditized offer, right? That's it. So I think for me, it's just, and then, so for most software companies, what they don't realize is that, so if you have this like two by two matrix, customers smart, customers not so smart, lots of competition, not a lot of competition, right? You get these sort of four market conditions. And then what actually happens often is that not all of your product sits in the same quadrant, right? Maybe your base product for your smaller accounts sits in the, we have a lot of competition, but our customers are not very smart. Like they're like, they, which means that they have a lot of search costs. They need help buying. They can't figure out what's the right solution for them. There's a lot of solutions. So accounting software, like ERP systems for SMB, like there's a ton of them, very commoditized, but if you're really good at communicating to your specific avatar, then you can get those customers and they will trust you and they will buy from you. And then basically it's like, they know they might get a better deal elsewhere, but they like you and they like your solution and it's fine and the thing is okay. So that's where you end up, right? And then you might have another part of your market, other customers that you also serve, maybe with a different type of product that sits somewhere else where you are truly value-based. We say, hey, like this particular solution that we have is actually unique. I know that for smaller businesses, we have competitors, but for this like enterprise level offering that we have here, we're actually incomparable to anyone else. And you know that too, which is why we're not even going to compare pricing with the competitors. And then, so the good test is here is, do you have the guts to go through an RFP if they actually like really market test you? And you can sit at the end of it and say, sure, take the others. Yeah, I know that they're a third of the price. And then if your customer is truly sophisticated and you truly have differentiation, then they have to go with you anyways, or they will go with the cheaper competitors, burn out, and then get back to you 3 or 4 or 5 years later, all the wiser, right? So I think just making sure that like what conditions you're operating under with what customer segments and with what type of product can be the framework under which you make these pricing decisions, right? Are you going to be competitive on price? Are you going to be premium and really aggressive? Whatever it is, that's at least how I think about it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good framework of those quadrants. I've seen business models that kind of take the sophistication out. What they do is they go to market with value-based pricing, but they also deliver services. So they're not relying on your execution to deliver value. Okay, we're going to use the AI, we're going to use our own people, and we'll take cost out of your P&L. And that way they're assuring more. You may have been talking about sophistication of buying, but like sophistication of usage too. I don't know which you're referring to, but both are important. But so they offered like they're delivering AI plus services to deliver better outcomes for how you're running your organization. And then everyone makes money from that. It takes one element, one unknown out of the, because if I deliver software to you, you don't know how you're going to use it and whether you're going to be good at it. And, you know, well, you don't know your own, you can't really guarantee that when you're the vendor, software vendor.
No, so actually you're touching on one of like favorite topics in software pricing, which is services. And I think services is a hugely underutilized like power play in monetizing a lot of software. Because so we do a lot of these redesigns, and then as part of that, we do validation interviews where we like walk customers through the packaging, pricing model, and so forth. And one of the most frequently asked questions, if not the most, is how good is the onboarding? Like, how are you going to help me use this solution? Like, it sounds awesome. I wish it was true, but are you going to help me get there? And I think it's just one signal, but I think it's to me, like it speaks to a larger truth, which is that the more you can, like there's some sort of ideal outcome, let's say 100% of the outcome, and then maybe your software does 95% of that, whatever, but there's always a gap. And usually people can close that gap, right? By training, by being there, by picking up the phone, whatever it is, or by proactively reaching out and monitoring, whatever it is that the solution does, but they can usually get like close the gap, maybe all the way to 100%. And what people don't understand is that doesn't add 5% of value. It more often than not adds 500% of value, but because it takes away the risk. So now I am certain that I'm going to get the outcome. And I'm also certain that I'm not going to be spending the late nights trying to push the buttons and whatever, use the solution, right? Because you are, and you're on there. So I think what really good services do is that you can charge money for them, so they cover their own costs. That's great. Also, they actually increase your conversion rate. Also, they actually defend a higher price point. Like you can charge more because it is a premium offering and you're backing it up with services. And it usually lowers your churn. Like it does all of the things you want done in terms of your unit economics and your software businesses. And people have this idea that, oh, we don't want to do services because like we fundamentally don't like humans because we're in the software business and they don't scale and all these things.
The scalability of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think for some things, that's the right solution. But for especially if you have like higher ticket, higher ACV, B2B solutions, adding services is a game changer. And if you look at companies like that IPO in the US and you look at sort of different stages of their journey, you can see that almost all of them today have services and almost none of them started with services. And you can see as they mature, they add them in, and it's part of the journey, right? So it's like, you're going to get there eventually, just start now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what question didn't I ask you that you wanted me to, that you might want to share with the audience?
I don't know. I really appreciated the discussion, by the way. So I think so I could do an hour more. So there's a ton of questions here. And I'm curious about your business too, but we'll save that for another time, Dean. So just really happy to talk about pricing and AI pricing in particular, I think is obviously quite hot right now.
Yeah, there one quick thing. Yeah, there seems to be like what you talked about. There seems to be maybe a potential market out there for credits and trading credits, and I don't know how that would work at a like software solution vendor point of view. It might work at like the large LLM point of view. I could trade Claude credits for GPT credits or whatever. But do you have any thoughts about that, where people are starting to talk about where there's you're gonna get these credits and you can start exchanging them and using them in other areas?
So I don't think I don't have any sort of the only way where you can get like cross system, like from one solution to another type credits is actually within a blockchain system. So you have something there. You can say that a lot of these coin offerings are essentially function as credits or tokens in some of these ecosystems. I don't think that's super hot right now. So I would say that what we do see is that a lot of companies are adopting credit-based pricing. So we monitor through with the media partner we have, we monitor about 3,000 pricing pages daily. And I've done so for years. And we track, so what kind of pricing models they have out. And you can definitely see an uptick in credit-based pricing, especially on, let's say, platform and infrastructure plays where you have compute and all these things, but actually also in a lot of others. I'm doing it right now for a cybersecurity business, US-based. I have done smaller credit cards in like for translation systems for learning management software, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's here to stay. And I think we're going to see a lot more credit systems inside products in the next couple of years.
Yeah. You're like, this is I've really enjoyed this conversation as well. And if the audience wants to get in touch with you, how can they find you and get in touch with you?
Sure. We have our website, which is willingnesstopay.com. Go there, sign up for, we have a newsletter. You can find my email, all these things. I wrote a book recently called The Pricing Roadmap.
I'll be
So
getting
I'll send you one. So for sure. And then, so it doesn't have anything about agentic AI pricing. I'm spending the summer writing a second edition. So you can hang up and so it'll come out in a fresher version this fall. But yeah, I think that's the website or the book. That's where it will start. Thanks.
amazing. Yeah, clearly you know what you're talking about. It's such an important part of going to market, and everything's changing with AI. So that good conversation. Thank you for coming on as a guest.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida. And Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.